15 temporary leaders. The situation late in that century seemed to call for a more steady form of government. The Bible tells us that it came to pass that when Samuel was old, that he made his sons judges over Israel. Now, the name of his firstborn was Joel, and the same name of his second was Abia. And they were Shoftim and Beersheba. And his sons walked not in his ways, but they turned aside after lucre, and they took bribes, and they perverted justice. Then all the elders of Israel gathered themselves together and came to Samuel unto Ramah and said unto him, Behold, you are old, and your sons walk not in your ways. As I entered the building this morning, one of you said unto me, You're talking about the next 4 years this morning, aren't you? I said, Yes. He said, Well, will you offer a prayer that before the next 4 years are out, the thermometer gets above freezing and we see a little sun? And I said that I would try, which is my way of saying that I'm grateful to all of you for having taken the time and the effort to come out on a bitter day to join in this worship of God as a congregation. On Thursday of this week, Jimmy Carter will take the oath of office as the 39th President of the United States. I somehow confess that I find it difficult to speak of a President of the United States as Jimmy, but he's never called himself James, and I mean no disrespect. I'm sure that Thursday will be a deeply felt and emotional experience for the new president. After all, he devoted, sacrificed 2 years of his life to gain the office. He campaigned tirelessly for this moment. He's paid the price. And I only hope that when he enters the Oval Office and begins to serve, he'll find that the prize was worth the effort. For whatever else the presidency has been these last years, it has not been a road to happiness. The president can command a fleet of planes and of boats and of cars. He can command a legion of lackeys to do his will. He lives surrounded by adulation, by minions. Everything is made very easy for him. He moves with the great, the near great. There's no routine to his life. I'm sure he has the sense that he's not only making history, but making a place for himself in the annals of history. It must all be a very heady kind of life. But with it, in recent years, has come a full measure of frustration, grief, tears. Of our last four presidents, one was assassinated in office. And one so fell from grace in the eyes of his countrymen that he could not run for re-election, and he had to retire to a very restless retirement in his ranch. And a third had hastily to resign the office. If it remained any longer, he would surely have been impeached by the Senate. He remains now locked within the walls of San Clemente. And the fourth, a caretaker president, was allowed his short term of office and then essentially told by the nation, thank you, but no more. You're much better at playing golf than you are at being a president. No president of the United States in recent times has retired to the respect of his countrymen. None emerges as a great statesman, a man of sterling quality, memorable character. None has been allowed to serve out the full 8 years which are constitutionally allowed to a president. Mr. Carter assumes this office at a time when respect for the presidency, indeed respect for all of the institutions of government, has plunged to the depths. 1965, just 12 short years ago, political scientist at Yale University, Robert Lane, summarized all of the available polling data on the attitudes of the American people towards the government. He found that between 70 and 75% of them had great confidence in our political institutions, and only a slightly smaller number spoke with some happiness and some confidence of their elected officials. There was an essential bond of trust, at least at the upper reaches of government, between those who held office and those who elected them to office. All Americans, he found, were very cynical about ward politics and City Hall. They knew all about corruption and bribery on that level, that you could fix a parking ticket or buy some kind of adjustment in zoning or a license for your tavern. But they assumed, on the whole, that the higher a man rose in the government, the more he rose to the requirements of his office. The great model was Harry Truman, who had risen from the ward politics of old city, the worst of city politics in Kansas City, to become a respected and honored president of the United States. Now, 12 years later, the social scientists are telling us that between 60 and 70% of the American people are openly dissatisfied with their institutions of government, and a greater percentage than that are openly contemptuous of those who occupy the seats of power. In a recent series of investigations, 1 in 4 Americans volunteered, not an answer to a question, but simply volunteered, that all politicians are corrupt and immoral. And they made no difference, as had once been done, between the levels at which a politician was in office, between the ward healer and the president of the United States. A blanket of dissatisfaction, disappointment, disgruntlement covers the land. We are deeply suspicious of all who have power. And we wonder whether, in fact, there will be any opportunity for us ever to regain a sense of confidence, both in our institutions and in those who are elected to be its stewards. Now, this truth, Mr. Carter knows full well. If it were not for this suspicion of Washington, of the presidency, he would not now be president. He emerged from the near obscurity of Georgia politics because he was from Plains, Georgia, a simple man from a small town who was not yet dirtied by the mud of the Potomac River. He suddenly burst onto the national scene because he promised to bring to Washington a new way of going about the business of government, or rather an old way. Open government, honest government, easy access of the people to their elected officials, and full disclosure by elected officials of the basis for their actions. Mr. Carter knows the depth of this feeling among Americans because the minute he began to go back on this image, when his candidacy emerged and assumed national prominence, The minute he began to speak with different emphases to different groups, the minute the American public began to suspect that here was another politician of the old familiar, all too familiar mold, his popularity began to plummet, nearly fatally. And if he had to fight any image during the last campaign, it was the image that he was simply another of the same. Another politician who will tell anybody anything as long as he thinks that that person wants to hear what he is saying and will, in return, vote for him. Now, no country such as ours, no political system which is based on a social compact, no system which is as delicately balanced as ours and which requires a bond of confidence between those who govern and those who are governed, no system such as ours can long exist in its present form unless this bond of confidence is reestablished. And I would submit to you that the urgent priority, I'd almost say the only basic responsibility that this new president will have during his term of office, is the responsibility to reestablish our sense of confidence in our government and in those who govern us. Now, it's easy to understand how we lost that sense of confidence. One word, in a sense, sums it up: Watergate. The plumbers, bad, dirty tricks, creep, very acronym, symbolic of a government by manipulation, of an underhanded form of government. But it's too easy, really, for any of us to assume that our disenchantment is due only to one bad apple, to Richard Nixon, to one megalomaniac who was willing and able to abuse the powers of office. That's too simple. In point of fact, investigations and revelations of the last months and years have made it clear that over 2 decades at least, those who govern us have tried to manipulate us, and they've tried to rule rather than to gain consent. Camelot, the presidency of Jack Kennedy, has been found to be also the time when wiretapping on a major scale was begun against selected Americans. We now know that we were not told the open, unvarnished truth about the Bay of Pigs or the assassination of President Diem. We now know that there were some very ugly so-called high living going on at the White House. During the presidency of Lyndon Johnson, we know that not only were agencies of the government abused, particularly the investigative agencies, not only did wiretapping continue, not only were we systematically lied to about the extent of our involvement in Vietnam and the extent of the failure of that involvement, but that at various times in his administration, both the Congress and the community were not told the truth about certain incidents which led to very consequential decisions, an example being the events in the Gulf of Tonkin, which led to the willingness of the Congress to make further commitments of troops, personnel, authority in that area. The presidency of Richard Nixon saw not only Richard Nixon, but Spiro Agnew, saw not only the continued misuse of the CIA and of the FBI, but now of the Internal Revenue Service, other investigative agencies, It saw the systematic opening of the mail of Americans. It saw the opening of mail between Americans. Apparently, there was no limit to which, in the name of success, in the name of a particular policy dear to them, that administration was not willing to go. And though the caretaker administration of Gerald Ford began, I think, to respond to this need for new confidence in government, I believe that Mr. Ford made a deliberate attempt in this respect. He certainly was never forthcoming and forthright with the American people about energy. He spoke what we needed to hear, but did not try to legislate what we needed to have happen. And again we saw this speaking with forked tongues, telling, as an example, to the Jewish community that, yes, this administration is deeply concerned with the Arab boycott and is in favor of certain kinds of legislation to prohibit American industry from cooperating with the boycott. At the same time, the members of the White House staff were on the Hill trying to sabotage all boycott legislation, and members of the administration were escorting the Saudi Arabian ambassador and others around Washington to tell various congressmen and senators There would be great cost, both in the cost of oil and otherwise, if such legislation was in fact enacted. The record is long, ugly, sordid, and it reached into all areas of Washington, reached into the Congress, Wilbur Mills and Wayne Hayes. It reached into the Congress, where he found that any number of senators and congressmen had received tarnished campaign contributions and even direct subsidies from special interest groups as varied as the South Korean government, corporations like Lockheed and AT&T. It reached into the regulative commissions of the government. Americans could hardly pick up a paper these last several years without reading one or another exposé of nonfeasance or malfeasance or misfeasance. It's no wonder that we've begun suspicious. We've ceased to really trust what those in authority tell us. Now, on Thursday next, the President will deliver an inaugural address. I'm sure he's worked hard over this address. It's the kind of historic piety that what an inaugural address is a consequential speech. And I'm sure that every weekly reader in schoolrooms across the country will feature that inauguration speech in their next issue, and that our newspapers will border it with some kind of dark color and give us the speech in full. But you know that the last inaugural address to which the American people paid any attention was that of President Kennedy's, now nearly 20 years ago, when he said to us, "Ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country." And out of that speech came the response which led to the Peace Corps and to VISTA. There certainly was a resurgence of community spirit all across the land. But at the same time, there was that recognition which began to emanate from that White House that not all was being told, that we were being manipulated rather than being consulted with, that there was a presidential agenda quite apart from whatever the popular consensus might be. And so whatever Mr. Carter will say this coming Thursday has been discounted in advance. I doubt that most of you will even bother to read it. You may read a line here or a line there that some headline writer pulls out of context. And if you do read it, you will not read it as if it reveals the true man. Because you know, and feel deep down that what it reveals is the man and the skill of any number of paid speechwriters. That it's a public statement for a public occasion, and very little more. And as if to prove this feeling that I have about our attitude, I picked up the paper last night after this lecture had been written, and I found an article by Richard Brunner of the News Enterprise Association. Let me read to you one or two paragraphs from it. Great phrases are as much a part of American history as the great men who coined them, or are they? Voters who heard President Ford's State of the Union speech this week and who will hear President-elect Jimmy Carter's inaugural address next week may well wonder. No matter what candidate you listened to in the past year, chances are many of his words were carefully put together by ghostwriters. The ex-newspaper man, the public relations flack, or the advertising copywriter who can mint history makers like, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, and ask not what your country can do for you, ask what you can do for your country, does himself and his boss proud. Never mind where the wordsmith found all these confidence-inspiring and elegant-sounding phrases. As long as they project an image of the candidate who is wise, witty, affable, trustworthy, sure-footed, urbane, and understanding, one who is knowledgeable in the affairs of man and God, then the political ghost is doing his job. But perhaps the cynicism of the age is overtaking the ghostwriter. For not only has the public come to doubt the politician's word, it also has begun to doubt that his words are his own. Perhaps by creating the multiple-choice personality candidate, wired together with memorable metaphor, acute alliteration, and sagacious simile, they've encouraged public cynicism. Perhaps those supers who lurk behind the seats of power have made their masters too credible, too congenial, too Mr. Know-it-alls for human belief. Perhaps not only the cynics are cynical when the chief ghostwriter who put words into Carter's mouth during the campaign is the same writer who wrote The President's Mistress, a book the New York Times called a racy novel about sex in the White House. Political ghostwriting is as old as the Republic. Although George Washington and Abraham Lincoln both wrote many of their speeches, both used ghosts, sometimes unwitting ones. Washington's farewell address was drafted by James Madison and polished by Alexander Hamilton, a writer who used the pen name of Caesar and Publius. This deed was considered so dastardly that its perpetrators kept it secret, lest its common knowledge shock the citizens to riot. In his acceptance speech to the Republican convention in Kansas City, President Ford closed his address, the address his six ghostwriters had labored over for 6 weeks, by promising to do what is right as God gives me to see the right. Ford's words had a familiar ring about them, and well they should. They were spoken by another Republican president 111 years ago. With malice towards none, with charity towards all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, that president had intoned on his second inaugural day. Those words were Abraham Lincoln's, or were they? And the question we will ask on Thursday is, these words are Jimmy Carter's, or are they? And we've come to a sorry pass in a democracy. When we no longer believe that a president's words really reflect the man, that he's really saying to us what he wants to say to us, that he's really speaking the truth to us, that he really is trying to lead us rather than to manipulate us. Yet that's precisely the situation of the presidency as Jimmy Carter enters it. And there can be no doubt about it. We no longer trust the President of the United States. We no longer trust the senior elected officials of our nation to speak to us openly and honestly and forthrightly. In brief, we know that the leaders of the country no longer trust us, for you speak the truth to people whom you trust. Now, in Western Europe, particularly in Western continental Europe, where there are elections and free institutions like our own, The people have long since lost faith in politicians. And they keep as much of their private lives to themselves as they can. There's a very clear separation or distance between the politician and the citizen. Part of the game of life is to not tell, to fudge on your taxes, to keep part of your life so totally concealed that the government cannot not know about it, not to completely speak your mind. But that's never been our way. And it would be a tragedy, would it not, if that openness which has characterized the American society for lo these many years were to disappear. There is no doubt that Mr. Carter assumes an office freighted with great power. He does not really need our consent to manage most of the ongoing responsibilities which are his. When he left Camelot, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. went to New York University to become a professor of history of the university. And he wrote a book which he called, as you'll remember, The Imperial Presidency. And in that book, he described the tremendous growth of power which has accrued to the office of the President of the United States in the last several generations. He offered many explanations. The inability of Congress, because so many congressmen represented special interest groups, to form policies which would, in fact, perform the necessary surgery, reforms on the American body politic. The country had to turn to some central authority. The vast growth of the bureaucracy corresponding to the growing intricacy of our economic and social life. And the fact that all of that bureaucracy is subsumed under the administration. The emergence of the United States as a superpower of the world and the inevitable accrual of power to the man who really controls and fashions and sculpts and manages our foreign policy. The basic weakness of the Congress at a time of great change. Congress essentially abandoned most of its powers. And we have seen the growth of the power of the office, and to that power, Mr. Carter will come to authority. He will have power over us and power over the lives of, directly over the lives of many men and many women. But it's one thing to discharge this power, and quite another thing to be President of the United States and to recognize the greatest need of all, the need to reestablish the confidence of the American people in the government. I'm quite convinced that Mr. Carter is an able man. I know that he will do all that he can to manage wisely the economy of the nation. I'm sure that he's a fine technician. We'll go over the budget, particularly the military budget, to see that we are getting value for money spent. I'm quite convinced that he will bring into his government men of quality and men, women of capacity who will be able to give him good guidance in the reconstruction of a social welfare program, which is now ramified to the point that no one is really sure how to gauge its effectiveness. I am sure that he will put his heads down with advisors and will discover and try to publish and effect for us an energy policy, which will make us both more economically secure and less dependent upon erratic forces in the Arab world. I'm sure that all of the technical things that the president is required to do will be done. He's an energetic man, vigorous man, and I'm sure that he wills this country to be strong, prosperous. What I'm not so sure about, but what I hope and pray will happen, is that he will recognize that underlying all of these responsibilities, there is one preeminent responsibility that is his. To be open, to be honest, to speak candidly, to reestablish the confidence of the American people in the Oval Office, the presidency. He knows the problem. He's shown that he is sensitive to some of the techniques which he will have to use in order to achieve his end. Under the administration of Mr. Johnson and Mr. Nixon, it was worth a candidate officer's neck to speak out in criticism of presidential policy. But I've noticed in recent weeks that some of those who have been appointed quite recently by Mr. Carter have been willing to speak out freely, and he's not publicly criticized them. He was criticized, as you recall, for not appointing a sufficient number of women to a significant office. And his response through his press secretary was that he could not find a sufficient number of qualified women. Well, one of the qualified women whom he found, the new Secretary of Commerce, Juanita Krebs, was quickly to say quite candidly and quite open, there are plenty competent women around. The president just didn't look for them. And there was no great thunder of outrage. She was not struck down or denied her appointment. And thus, this week, I noticed that at his confirmation hearings before the Senate, the Secretary of Labor designate, Roy Marshall, an economist from the University of Texas, said quite candidly that he believed that the $30 billion package which President Carter has suggested as a program to bring America out of the end of the recession, the so-called recession, and to bring back a greater degree of employment in the country. Policies which you remember require some minor tax rebates, money for public works and the like. Secretary of Labor Marshall said quite candidly he believed that this was the wrong policy, misguided, that what we needed to do was to find ways to put people to work, not simply to put a meaningless $100 or $150 of tax rebate in each person's pocketbook. And again, there was no great cry of outrage from the White House. That augurs well for a government which is open to criticism from within. It augurs well also that Mr. Carter has seen the importance of consulting openly and easily with the legislature. Before this $30 billion project was announced, he had a day-long meeting in Plains with the leaders of the Congress. And apparently they emerged from that meeting convinced that they had not simply been told what will be, but had actually been consulted. A number of them said we were able to make major changes in the program which the president will in fact submit. And a few days after this meeting of Plains, there was a meeting in the Smithsonian Institute in Washington, in which leading Congress people and senators who are responsible in the areas of foreign affairs were invited to sit down with Mr. Vance and the others who will be charged with foreign policy. Briefed and fine discussion apparently took place of the major concerns of the nation in that area. Obviously, Mr. Carter is sensitive to the need. But there's one thing to be sensitive to the need in the early days of your administration, when you have a vast majority in the Congress, where the people wish you well, where the pressures of administration have not yet mounted, where in fact you've not yet entered the Oval Office, and quite another to be as patient and as open and as willing to listen to other suggestions under the terrible pressure which must inflict any man who occupies that overwhelming job. I am sure that as the days become months and the months become years, Mr. Carter will often get impatient. He will know what's right for the nation because it's been made clear to him by his advisors. God willing, he will always have the time to take the time, make the time, to reveal these facts to the nation and to trust to our good judgment. And I know there'll be many times when he'll be very angry with members of Congress or with other groups in the nation who oppose him on something he knows to be right in some area. And God willing, he will not try to manipulate public opinion, but simply try to make his case. And when he cannot get his way, accept that, to do what he can, not to be an imperial president who rules us, but a democratic president who guides us and tries to lead us, but who ultimately accepts the fact that this is a free society, and the people must have their say, and ultimately, they must have their way. I find this country, as we approach the next 4 years, very much in the situation of a young woman, let's say, in her early 20s, quite beautiful woman, who has been romanced by a number of suitors. They've told her many loving things. They've offered her many beautiful trinkets. And she's listened. And she's fallen in love. And they have loved and left. And she's now in her early 20s, no longer a child. She believes herself wise to the ways of the world. She believes herself to be without any confidence whatsoever. And men, they're all only after what they can get. Well, for such a young lady to find the right man, a decent man, she must engage, use her will to deliberately suspend disbelief, deliberately put behind some very bad experiences, in the confidence that there are people of decency and honor out there. That's the position we're in. As a new administration begins, we must deliberately, I believe, suspend our suspicions. We must deliberately put behind us the bad experiences of the last years and give the new suitor a chance. There are honorable men. And until we have ample proof otherwise, we must do our share, I believe, towards re-knitting the political fabric. If we insist that all politicians are corrupt and all administrations are venal and self-serving, this country is going to break down over the next years into a series of competing special interest groups who will demand more and more because there is no confidence that they will receive their fair share. And all sense of community will disappear. And those who govern us will fear us, and we will fear those who govern us. And suspicion will begin to corrode and rot the inner soul of the nation. We have to give this new administration a chance. We have to put behind us Watergate and all the exposures of the last years and say that this is more or less a new cast of people. This president understands, he's voiced some of the same things we have been saying. There are good men. And God willing, he and those he have appointed are to be numbered among them. As As I look forward to the next 4 years, I'm confident that they're going to be difficult years. Years full of problems, domestic and foreign. I'm confident that when these 4 years are over, and this president defends the record of his office, you'll be able to point to some successful programs which he has initiated and some which were not so successful. He will be able to point to some initiatives in foreign policy which seem to reduce the degree of tension in the world. His opponents will point to other initiatives which have not been so successful. It'll be a mixed bag, as it must always be, given what life is. But I pray that when we look back on these 4 years, we approach a new election, we will say whatever we want to say about this policy or that. But we will be able to say, you know, I feel better about the presidency. I feel better about our political system. What's happened these last 4 years has renewed my faith. Amen.